Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, millions of Americans who rely on SNAP benefits facing uncertainty today because of the federal government shutdown and dueling court orders. What does it mean for families locally, including thousands of kids and seniors? Coming up, we speak with John Little, the county's Commissioner of Health and Human Services, about what's happening with SNAP, WIC, HEAP, and local food support. A single deer donation can feed families across a whole community, and hunters in New York are stepping up to do just that. We'll hear how the Venison Donation Program has already delivered tens of thousands of pounds of food to pantries across the state. Plus, local economic perspective from James B. Huntington. And culture reporter Valerie Manzi chats with Laura Shane Cunningham about her edgy new comedy Bang coming to the Rosendale Theater after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The U.S. Supreme Court has issued an order this morning. It has rejected a call to review its prior decision legalizing same-sex marriage. A county clerk from Kentucky, once jailed for refusing to issue same-sex marriage licenses, had asked the high court to reconsider its decision. It has refused. President Trump has issued a sweeping pardon of his allies related to the 2020 presidential election and the effort to falsely claim Trump won. The pardon names numerous Trump campaign attorneys and people who met 5 years ago when they tried to create alternate electoral slates. NPR's Miles Parks reports.
The document pardons all those associated with a plot to make false electoral slates that could have potentially interfered with the presidential certification on January 6, 2021. It names Trump campaign attorneys Rudy Giuliani, Kenneth Chesbrough, Mark Meadows, and John Eastman, as well as dozens of other people who met often in secret to sign documents claiming they were legitimate electors in states actually won by Joe Biden. The pardons are essentially symbolic, as none of the people pardoned have been charged with federal crimes. Some are charged in their individual states, but the pardon has no impact on those cases. Miles Parks, NPR News, Washington.
An independent senator and a group of Democratic senators broke ranks to vote with Republicans yesterday on spending legislation. This would take steps to reopen the federal government. One Democrat who voted with Republicans is Nevada Senator Catherine Cortez Masto. She says the group got a promise from the Senate Majority Leader in exchange for their support. She says Republicans are supposed to take up the issue of much higher health care premiums Americans will pay for Affordable Care Act policies next year.
We will find out. Part of the agreement that we entered into, and you heard it, was Leader Thune said he would come to the table on a health care once the government was open. And now he's got to follow through. He gave us a December date, and now they've got to follow through. And the American public will see where, at the end of the day, Republicans lie.
She spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. Stocks opened higher this morning on hopes that an end could be in sight for the government shutdown. NPR's Scott Horsley has more.
Markets would welcome a resolution to the shutdown, which has idled hundreds of thousands of federal workers, held up funding for vital safety net programs, and disrupted air travel. The shutdown's also delayed the release of closely watched economic data, including a jobs report that was due last Friday and an inflation update that was supposed to come out this week. Stock in Tyson Foods opened higher after the meatpacking giant issued a bullish sales forecast for the coming year. Tyson's chicken sales were up during the most recent quarter. The company sold fewer pounds of beef, but made up for it with higher prices. And the company behind By Heart Whole Nutrition Infant Formula is recalling two lots after more than a dozen cases of infant botulism. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR. A super typhoon that hit the Philippines over the weekend has left at least two people dead. More than a million others evacuated their homes ahead of the storm. As Michael Sullivan reports, this latest storm follows a deadly typhoon that hit the Philippines last week.
Fung Wong came ashore in northeastern Aurora province with sustained winds of up to 115 miles per hour and gusts of more than 140 miles per hour. It set off floods and landslides and knocked out power to entire provinces, even as the country dealt with the devastation left by Typhoon Kalmagi, which struck the country on Tuesday, leaving at least 224 dead. At least five more people were killed after Kalmagi cleared the Philippines and slammed into an already storm-battered Vietnam. Fung Wong weakened as it traveled across the northern Philippines overnight before blowing into the South China Sea, its forecast to head to the northwest towards Taiwan. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai.
President Trump is scheduled to welcome Syria's interim president Ahmad al-Sharaa to the White House today. They're expected to formalize their agreement, bringing Syria into a coalition that battles Islamic State militants. Former French President Nicolas Sarkozy has been released from a French prison today. He has been released under judicial supervision as he waits for his appeal against a criminal conviction. Sarkozy was convicted earlier this year for conspiracy linked to campaign finance charges. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison. He's been behind bars for a few weeks. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Imaginable Futures, funding programs in the U.S. with the goal of ensuring young children and their parents get the education they need to thrive. Learn more at imaginablefutures.com. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Millions of Americans who rely on SNAP benefits are caught in uncertainty this morning as a legal tug of war continues over funding during the federal government shutdown. Over the weekend, the Trump administration instructed states to reverse full SNAP payments that were issued during a brief window when a federal judge ordered funding to resume. That was before a Supreme Court justice temporarily blocked that ruling. Late Sunday, a federal appeals court kept the judge's order in place for now, but the Supreme Court's pause means states still don't know what benefits they're supposed to deliver or when. So what does this all mean for folks who depend on food assistance? Right now, we're joined by John Little, Commissioner of Health and Human Services and Commissioner of Social Services in Sullivan County. John, thanks for being here, because this has gotten very confusing. How did these developments since last week impact SNAP benefits right now for Sullivan County residents?
Yeah, confusion is definitely the word of the day, Tim. But you know, the good news, I think, here in New York is Governor Hochul, to her great credit, has decided to press ahead based on the actions that USDA took during the day on Friday before the case fully percolated up to the Supreme Court's level. So our understanding this morning is that folks have already started receiving full November SNAP benefits in the state of New York, and that's expected to continue over the course of this week. So anybody that has recurring benefits, they'll be getting those full benefits over the course of this week. And then anyone new to the program that applied this month, their applications will be processed for payment shortly thereafter.
So this was an order from Governor Hochul on Friday and saying that these SNAP benefits were expected to be delivered on Sunday. And as far as you know, that did happen here in New York.
Yeah, so anecdotally, I've heard that it has gone out to at least a few folks. I have no idea how many at this point. That's something that you'd have to get from the state level. But benefits have started going out. The information I can share from the state over the course of the weekend was, yes, they were continuing to process the release of full benefits, which started yesterday.
And in Sullivan County, nearly 15% of the population, folks rely on SNAP. That's about 12,000 residents or households there, or residents in the households there. How are you communicating these constantly shifting updates to folks?
It's a lot of work, I'll be honest. But it's... I think what is keeping me, you know, really engaged and encouraged as we deal with this chaos and confusion from Washington is that a lot of local agencies now have really stepped up. The communications across agencies are very good. So, you know, here at Sullivan County Social Services, you know, we know what Catholic Charities has done, that they've brought in more than a ton of food for distribution at their regular food pantries. Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan is raising funds. Single Bite is raising funds. Cornell Community Cupboard has already done some big fundraising with Marty and Lynn Colavito's walk to raise funds. Federation for the Homeless has stepped up. So there's a lot of different resources available right now. I'm actually more concerned about HEAP, to be honest, at this point, because We have no way forward for heat benefits right now.
Yeah,
because that's completely dependent on the shutdown ending.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about HEAP. HEAP is that winter heating support. Originally, I think the last time we spoke, we thought that that might be delayed, but now it seems it's delayed indefinitely. I think you had maybe thought maybe by November 17th, but now it looks like indefinitely because of this shutdown. And despite the, I guess, efforts in Washington to move forward to reopen the government, it still doesn't help with the heat benefits at this point.
Yeah, at this point, I mean, I know a lot is there's been significant progress in the Senate over the weekend, but what that means for the Home Energy Assistance Program, not sure about that yet. And regardless, it sounds like there's still some negotiating that needs to happen. But that has been our concern is, you know, it has gotten cold. We've seen a few snowflakes, and we're going to see a few more this week. So it's quite a struggle. We did, HEAP was supposed to start, if the shutdown hadn't happened, it was supposed to start on November 3rd. Our initial delay was to the 17th, and now it's indefinite because there's just no way of forecasting which way we're going to go. So at this point, we fully expect that HEAP benefits won't even be available until, I would say, at the earliest, the 24th, which means some folks, the only respite we're going to be able to provide them is warming centers, which will open next Friday. So that's one thing we are doing. And then we can also assist folks with emergency public assistance benefits for heating, but they have to qualify. The standards for public assistance to qualify are tighter than they are for the HEAP program in general. So it's a lot for staff to absorb as well. Trying to figure out, you know, how we can help folks under these restrictive conditions.
You mentioned colder temperatures this week. In fact, the National Weather Service says the low tonight 25, tomorrow's high only 32, low of 25 tomorrow night again. So these are some of the coldest temperatures we've seen so far this season. What and you mentioned the warming centers don't open until next week. What can folks do if they're, you know, in a heating emergency, especially during this cold snap in the next 24 to 48 hours?
Well, yeah, and it is important for folks to know that here in New York, we have what's known as Code Blue, which is orders from the governor and a program for which all counties are funded to provide emergency housing to anyone when the nighttime temperature dips below 32 degrees. So we do that before the warming centers open by putting folks up in hotels, you know, in any circumstance, we want to know if somebody has a home, certainly we can provide them with a hotel room if they're in an emergency state and, you know, there's no heat in their home. But we would prefer to help people out. So, you know, we encourage people to get in contact with us to see if we can help them with emergency benefits before we have to resort to an emergency sort of placement. But that is available to folks if it's needed.
Also wanted to touch base on WIC. You had mentioned in your United Partner update last week to folks who you regularly communicate with, United Sullivan Partners, about the status of WIC. What's the status of the WIC program during this federal shutdown?
Yeah, so the latest word we have from the Department of Health is that the federal government shutdown is not impacting WIC operations in New York State. So there is information for anybody that receives WIC on the particular ins and outs that they can get from the Department of Health. But that program is still fully running. And just to remind our folks that because for a long time that program did run out of Sullivan County Public Health, but we now have that administered by our partner Sun River Health here in Liberty in the Sullivan Mall and Sullivan Avenue. But yeah, they are fully up and operational right now.
You mentioned your staff trying to help folks out. How are you guys holding up? I always want to check in on you guys because there's a human face behind the folks that are trying to help other humans.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And it's actually a little funny because we've been waiting for a long time to get some flooring replaced. Our carpets in our building are 30 years old. but fortunately, the county legislature supported us getting a renovation, which is going to be nice, a healthier building for my staff. But that is the floor is being replaced in the midst of all this. So it's a bit chaotic in social services. So we appreciate everyone in the public and their patience. You know, by and large, everyone is holding up really well. I'm really proud of my staff and, you know, what we do to help folks. And, you know, I always encourage folks that, you know, social services can be a real chore to deal with because of the administrative red tape that goes with it. But I really feel strong about the partnerships we've developed in the community that, you know, even if social services might be a difficult path to get some help, We try not to be, but if we are, we have other partners in the community that we work with very closely these days. And, you know, it's one of those situations where many hands makes the lift lighter. So, we feel pretty good about where we're at, as stressful and chaotic as the situation is these days.
Yeah, and just, you know, the government is inching closer to reopening after this Senate deal, but that doesn't mean it's reopened now or it's happening anytime soon. It still has to go through the deal pass in the Senate and go back to the House, and then that gets approved. So if this doesn't happen in the next few weeks, if it persists, what's your biggest fear here?
Well, I'd say my biggest fear is that if we're not resolved, you know, later into this month, then the snap situation can become, I think, pretty dire once we get to the Christmas holidays. So everything I'm hearing from our various partners is that, you know, food banks have been preparing for a while for the Thanksgiving holiday. So although things are strained in general because of the way things have been going with the federal government, we were well prepared as a community for what we're dealing with today. If this continues into December and temperatures get colder, you know, we're going to have real impacts of, you know, hungry, cold, tired people. And that's really unfortunate because it seems like, well, I prefer not to get into, you know, the partisan politics of it. There does seem to be an element of folks who, you know, seem to be, you know, the cruelty seems to be a feature. It's a leverage tool, and the poor and downtrodden in our community should not be used as tools for a political negotiation.
If you or someone you know needs help with SNAP or WIC or HEAP or looking for food support, where would you tell folks to go?
So there's different ways to get to us. I would say the OTDA website is a very good resource for up-to-date information, and really that's as easy as a Google search for Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance. If you'd like to talk to us on the phone, we always have a human being at the other end of the line when you call our switchboard, and that's at 845-292-0100. And we're open from 8 to 5, Monday through Friday. We will be closed tomorrow for the Veterans Day holiday. But we'll still be very much engaged in what's going on and staying in tune so that we can help people right away on Wednesday morning.
That's John Little, Commissioner of Health and Human Services and Commissioner of Social Services for Sullivan County, giving us that local perspective on the confusion and chaos that the federal shutdown is creating on food and energy assistance programs for our local residents. John, thank you so much again, and hang in there.
Thanks a lot, Tim. It's always good to talk to you.
You can also find links to food assistance and food resources at our website, wjffradio.org. We'll take a break, and when we come back, as food insecurity rises and SNAP benefits are delayed during this shutdown, food banks are relying on help from a surprising place, hunters. We talk with Feeding New York State about how the donated venison becomes thousands of meals for local families this hunting season. That story is next. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
The need is growing. More families in our community are struggling to put food on the table. Local food pantries are on the front lines, but they need help. You can make a difference by donating non-perishable food, personal care items, and baby supplies, or by volunteering to support and distribute these donations. It's about nourishing our neighbors. Visit WJFFradio.org for info to help ensure everyone in our community has enough to eat. Radio Catskill, keeping our neighbors connected.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear some jazz heat, bongo beat, plus the Voodoo 5 plays the Dead Kennedys. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Wednesday night at 7, here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, amid delays in SNAP benefits during the government shutdown and as food insecurity continues to rise across the New York and the region, hunger relief organizations are looking for every resource available, including help from hunters. For more than 15 years, Feeding New York State has partnered with hunters and processors to turn donated deer into high-protein meals for families in need. I spoke with Kathleen Stress, Executive Director of Feeding New York State, about how the venison donation program works, and why safety and education are key, and the growing demand their network of food banks is facing this season.
So the mission of Feeding New York State is to lead a unified effort for a hunger-free New York State. We do so in partnership with our 10 regional food banks across the state and ensuring that they have the monetary and food commodities available to help supplement the work that they're doing. And this part of the supplementing is the venison donation program. We have been leading this effort for, over 15 years, and it's an opportunity for hunters to donate that high protein that's always requested at our food pantries and emergency programs.
How does the program work? How does a deer donated by a hunter actually end up feeding someone in need?
So it's a very easy program. And so that's why we want to continue to get the word out. Hunters donate at any type of registered meat processor in their area. And on our website, we do highlight some in each county. And it's an opportunity to, once you tag your deer and you bring it to the processor, that processor, you fill out one form that indicates you want to make it a donation to a food bank in your area. And what happens is that meat gets processed. It gets put into retail-sized packs of 1 or 2 pounds. And then the local food bank is contacted by that processor to pick up that item or have it delivered, and then it goes out for distribution through that food bank's territory or service area to local pantries and food programs.
Why are things like using non-lead ammunition and proper handling so important in this whole process?
Well, because we really, I think, want to ensure that families have the information that allow them to decide whether venison is the best choice for their family, right? And sometimes lead or non-lead is an indicator. So we've done a lot of work with our partners at Department of Health and through New York State Department of Environmental Conservation to ensure that the public has consumption educational materials, right? So then they can make the best choice for themselves.
Are there any stories or examples from hunters or food banks that you've heard over the course of this program being enacted and the impact it's had so far?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would like to share, first of all, on an annual basis, hunters donate anywhere from 60 to 70,000 pounds of food. So you're looking at 2 truckloads
Wow.
of venison that is donated to our neighbors in need. And I will say, I was just at the town hall and a hunter was getting his license and he talked about how he's participated in the program for years and he hoped to be sure to donate again this year. And so I think hunters understand what a great commodity of protein it is, and then the opportunity to enjoy hunting, but if they can't use all the venison, how to make sure that someone in their local community can help and take that in. And so it's been a really beneficial program. And again, I think in a very short time frame when hunting season occurs, you know, from September through January, the ability to get 70,000 pounds of food or of venison is a really important highlight.
Given the time that we're in now with food insecurity rising, the government shutdown causing that delay in SNAP benefits for folks, maybe hunters will be out there with that in mind.
I hope so. I mean, this is part of the outreach and education to encourage hunters to understand that how they can help feed their local communities. You know, the benefit is that we have a program through this venison donation to be able to offset some of the processing fees for the processor, right? So it becomes a true donation. And it's really an opportunity to help ensure that this high commodity protein is available to our neighbors.
And during this time, as you've noted, as we've noted, and many folks have noted, that there are potentially 3 million New Yorkers who are at risk now with this delay in SNAP benefits, and the food banks and partner agencies are finding increased need. Anything you could address there from the Feeding New York State perspective of how you can help, or other things you want folks to know?
Sure. I mean, I think we're all, yes, going through the implications of the government shutdown. I want to really share that food banks are stepping up. We're preparing what we call almost like an disaster response. We're ensuring that we have mass distributions, mobile distributions to meet the needs of the community members for November. I will say, sadly, we are not going to be food bank our way out of this. Food banks generally statistically provide one meal to nine meals that SNAP can provide. So I want to urge the community members listening to contact your congressman, reach out to your elected officials, and let them know how valuable the SNAP program is.
Feeding New York State has some really unique programs. We were highlighting the one for hunters donating their deer. There are other programs. Don't chuck it, truck it. That's a good one. Talk about some of the other unique things that you do to partner with government and donors and food industry to reduce food waste and then get that food to people that need it.
Yeah, I mean, you just highlighted our food recovery program. You know, we have an opportunity to work with food generators who are required to donate. We connect them to the local food bank or food programs to ensure that those edible foods are going to people who can use them versus the landfill. I'm proud to say that since our inception of that program in 2022, we've already moved 65 million pounds of food. So it is a worthwhile opportunity. In addition to that, we have been very lucky to have funding that supports dairy access and increasing distribution of dairy to our neighbors through food pantries and through our food banks, highlighting opportunities to work with smaller to mid-sized dairy processors across the state. And they're working to get their product out by distributing directly to food pantries. And so that has been a great opportunity to increase dairy by about 4.6 million pounds. And so, you know, that is a great opportunity that we hope to see continue while we support our farmers and growers. And then in addition, we have a really unique produce sourcing program that helps supplement produce that our food banks are acquiring. And we work with growers and farmers across the state on opportunities to acquire not only hard seven, but some of the row veg opportunities that they can't move throughout the year and provide that. And this year alone, we just finished our fiscal year ended in June, and we moved 48 million pounds of produce, additional produce, to our food banks. So the network is banding together. We're ensuring that we work closely with our donors, farmers, growers, producers to ensure that our food banks have the food resources they need.
If folks want to learn more, get involved, or if there are hunters or even processors listening and want to know more about this venison donation program, how can they get involved? How can they learn more?
So, certainly the easiest way is to look up on our website, feedingnys.org, and it has a venison hunter section page. Certainly that is the best way, and our food sourcing and food recovery coordinator, Cassidy, her number is available online for that. And certainly we're happy to answer any questions through that portal.
That's Kathleen Stress, Executive Director of Feeding New York State. Again, more information at feedingnys.org. Kathleen, thank you so much.
Thank you for the time.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Bill Williams. Join me Tuesday for the Kingfisher Project. My guest will be Bridget Brennan of the New York City Special Narcotics Prosecutor's Office.
I think the most important thing that people should know is that the drug supply is very dangerous, that there's help available, and that all of us are working towards the same goal.
That's the Kingfisher Project, Tuesday evening at 6 on the local edition, only on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and it's Monday, so it must mean it's time to hear from James B. Huntington, local author, local economist, for some local economic perspective. James B., happy Monday. Good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Okay, so we heard that the Senate may be inching closer to a deal on the government shutdown. So what's going to happen now?
What's going to happen now is they need to make its way through Congress, including the House. So it will still need to be debated. It will still need to be passed officially by the Senate. It will need to win approval in the House and be signed by President Trump. So how long they take to do this is unknown to me and apparently to the commentators and reporters here. There are Democrats who may take steps to resist and delay it, those who did not agree to step over to the Republican side where they got their 60 votes. So we don't know, but it's not going to be anything immediate, and it could well not be done by the end of this week. But the advantage is that we seem to have ended the silent logjam, and there is a way out of this.
So it's not over yet, but there is some movement. In the meantime, what's happening with American household debt? It looks like it's hitting some new highs.
It reached a new record. Yes, it did. An all-time record in the third quarter of this year. We have, it's $18.59 trillion. Mortgage balances were up $137 billion in the quarter. Credit card balances up $24 billion. Auto loan balances stayed the same, but student loan balances went up $15 billion. So they're still high. We also have delinquency rates described here as elevated, with 4.5% of all this outstanding debt is in some stage of delinquency. The serious delinquencies, 90 days or longer, were generally stable, except possibly for student loans. So, but the lower level, the earlier delinquency things are going up yet a little more. So, people are borrowing more money. It's easy to see why if you have government workers and such recently, due to the shutdown, added to the large sets of people. So there are a lot of problems here.
Yeah. I mean, it looks like economic growth has been solid overall, but then there's this sort of divide between less affluent households and more affluent households. And with this, you know, rise in debt, it looks like those less affluent households are struggling a little bit.
Yes. Absolutely. We really have had a split that came up in the last year or two right there, where people on the higher end are benefiting from a lot of administration's policies and doing better at work in general.
All right.
People who are younger and just starting out have real problems with jobs, not only getting them, but working them.
Well, let's talk about that. Our favorite subject, Gen Zers. How are they relating to working versus unemployment?
Well, what's happening is the unemployment is high because there's been really a 50-year trend of fewer and fewer entry-level jobs. We also have the ever lower barriers to entry when someone puts a job online and they get hundreds, thousands of applications. It was often that people could find niches or areas which were not very well known in the public, especially through personal contacts, but so many employers now are just throwing these things online, which causes vast, very vast amounts of competition. So this piece that was written by Jessica Gross in the New York Times says that once you actually have a job, the real dystopia begins. We have general complaints at the entry level with far less mentorship and more micromanaging. we have employers expecting you to do more and more and advising less and less on what to do. There are tracking a lot of bossware software, which is designed to track productivity, so tracking keyboard use, movements, and phone calls, and some are actually docking employers money for time that they perceived they would be idle, which anyone who's worked a cubicle job or anything close to that knows that it's hardly continuous work, and you have things like conversations with co-workers and other consultations and many things that cause your work to be less than continuous. So that's really a reactionary trend here. And so a lot of workers under 25 have a rise in despair.
And this piece also mentions the impact of the rapid rise of AI, too, in terms of like the despair or the feeling of not feeling comfortable in employment or in the job.
But strangely enough, it's not the problem you might think. I mean, AI has so many problems and is so really poor at low-level office work that it's not gobbling up all these jobs by itself. The problem is that people are using it often as a substitute for decent supervision. So you have they send you these jobs to an AI platform, and it often just doesn't work very well. It still has a lot of problems with bogus information one way or another. So it's a discouraging thing, and it's probably hanging over people's minds that someday it will, maybe soon it will start taking over jobs and left and right. But that really isn't the problem. The problem is just a larger and larger amount of entry-level jobs going away, being consolidated, being moved on to other things, so the positions just aren't there in the first place, and often those that are just buried with competitors.
Let's talk about another area that AI is into. Well, it's in every area, but what about medical advice? What are the benefits and harms of consulting with AI for medical advice?
Yes, a lot of people doing that. They're talking about Dr. Chat, GPT, really using AI for medical advice. So sometimes that can be very good. And there are probably, I'm sure, we have listeners who are doing that now. So I'll say what the advice they have here is that, first, their chatbots are still notorious for making things up, and they do often offer faulty medical advice. What they're good for is creating a list of questions to ask your doctor, simplifying medical record jargon, or walking you through a diagnosis or a treatment plan. One thing you have to watch out for is chatbot's tendency to be sycophantic and relentlessly validating. It says, yes, yes, yes. And it pushes you in directions. A leading question, do you think I should do something, get an MRI or schedule a medical appointment? You may get the wrong information there because the chatbots are sort of trained to please you. So one suggestion made here is that you put these things in the third person and you ask things like, what would you tell a patient who has a bad cough, instead of saying, I have a bad cough. So they won't agree with you as much. So you could even ask, what would you say that he might not want to hear? Ask questions like that and see what comes out. So it's on the way. It's better. It's certainly worth something. I mean, there's the sites that are out there now, like WebMD, are quite valuable, but none of that stuff is a substitute for a true medical diagnosis. It can give you insight. It can tell you what range you're sort of in with something, but it won't really replace a doctor.
What about in the area of mental health and talk therapy? How is it doing there?
Well, it's moving along. There are mixed reviews, different reviews on it. Even chatbots can act like therapists by asking similar questions, the same kind of questions they would. Often they, people in crisis or whatever, just learning really some of the more basic things about being in therapy, like being willing to disclose a lot of personal things, and lying to your therapist is about as smart as lying to your lawyer. And a remarkable number of people fall into that trap for some reason or another. So if you have AI, it can be sort of like a preliminary low-level therapist. But it's not going to be a total substitute. It could be valuable, and it may give you ideas you haven't thought of that have some merit and such. So it's worth something, but it's not, as it now stands, anywhere near to becoming a full substitute for a human therapist.
All right, let's talk about a bold move that one country is making to reduce smoking, a country you may not think about or may not think is doing something like this.
Yes, it is. Okay. The idea, which has come up before, is setting a date after which nobody born will ever be able to buy tobacco products. So when they turn 18, or whatever the legal age is in these places, they are still barred. Whereas if you're even a day younger than this border, or a day older rather than this border, you will be able to do it once you reach the legal age. But the idea is to pre-identify sets of people who will not be allowed to smoke at all. This is coming up in the Maldives. It actually has just started in November. Anybody born after January 1st, 2007 can no longer buy tobacco or vaping products, which are generally illegal in the country otherwise, I mean, anyway, not being able to buy tobacco in any form, and they will, as long as the law holds, never do that. So it's an intriguing idea. If they can keep this going for, say, 20 years, you might have almost everyone below 40. You'll have microscopic rates of smoking, which certainly anybody in healthcare and many of the rest of us think that would be just fine. So it's been tried in other places, or almost tried in other places. New Zealand came up with one starting in 2009, and they were going to make that a law in 2024, meaning that if their age for smoking is 16, it would have made a difference to these people the next year. But it was struck down. They decided not to go ahead with it. Britain also is considering something like that, also January 1st, 2009. But there will be a lot of eyes on this tropical paradise sort of country, the Maldives, seeing how they do, how it works out. They are really a first world country, so they have similar problems and substantial prosperity. So if it works there or doesn't work there, it will tell a lot to the rest of the world, and it could be really a wonderful thing for, I mean, vast hundreds of billions of dollars being saved in healthcare if we could really eradicate tobacco without just banning it and having criminal forces and such dealing with it, and hardcore addicts not being able to get it, to prevent those people from popping up in the first place. Could be very, very good, but it's still unknown how it will go, or even if the people there will tolerate it and not roll it back.
Also, the Maldives attracts thousands of international visitors each year, and the Health Ministry explicitly confirmed that the new smoking regulations apply equally to tourists, too.
Yes, they do. They apply to everyone, and be aware of that. If you're a teenager or something and you would like to be able to smoke, then maybe that's not the place to go to.
All right. Let's do the numbers. How were they this morning, and how did they change?
Okay. I have my usual early morning numbers here, and I have something to say about what happened to a couple of them since then, because the news about the shutdown, there being a path out of it, helped world markets greatly, and as soon as trading started at 9:30 this morning in this country, they jumped up. We have gold, $40.79 plus $77 over the week, down last week. It was under 4,000 for 3 or 4 days, but it went up near the end. Silver, $49.77, that's plus $1.22, gives you a ratio of 82-1. That also rebounded next week. Now the Dow, as of early this morning, before any trading started, it was 46,987, or down 576 on what was really a profit-taking and fear about AI being a bubble. That really was what colored most of last week. But it was up 300 from that almost right out of the gate this morning. The NASDAQ, 23,005 early this morning, down 720. A lot, just more and more noises about an AI bubble and general fear. However, that went up 400 early this morning, so people are not as concerned, and they're just a lot, they're very happy about that we might not be in this shutdown forever. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, $60.41, down 54 cents. OPEC Plus will probably increase production, which is going to keep it low for a while unless they change their minds. So Bitcoin, 106,474, down 620. That's a mild week for that volatile item. British pound, 1.3171, up 47 hundredths of a cent. It's partially regained last week's loss. Euro, much the same, 1.1567, up 45 hundredths of a cent. So it's looking better for those currencies, especially with U.S. interest rates going down. Japanese 100 yen sat again at 65 cents. So overall, I think the profit-taking in general is now over. A lot beyond this, what happens with this government shutdown is going to depend on traders' perceptions of what AI is going to do next. There are different opinions. There have been more and more vast amounts of money being spent on these data centers. So we'll see. Hang on.
Hang on. Keeping us informed. It's James B. Huntington with the Local Economic Perspective. We'll talk to you next Monday. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. And turning to some culture now, Bang is an underground comedy that's equal parts hilarious and disturbing. You can catch a stage reading at the Rosendale Theater on Sunday. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with author Laura Shane Cunningham about what makes Bang so outrageous, thought-provoking, and impossible to forget.
Good morning. Today, my guest is Laura Shane Cunningham, and she is here to talk about her underground play. And underground has kind of an additional meaning. It's a black comedy. It's called Bang. And there will be a staged reading at the Rosendale Theater on Sunday, November 16th at 2 p.m. And she's here to talk about that. But before we get into it, I'd just like to say some of you might have read Laura's work. She's a memoirist, a novelist, a playwright, essayist, a journalist. She calls herself a trans writer. So I thought she's across disciplines. Okay. And I was intrigued to find the backstory about how you came to write Bang.
I began actually as a columnist for the New York Times, and I went out to research the big business of Armageddon. The actual first article appeared in the 80s, still able to be summoned up online. I'm looking at it, in fact. I wanted to see what I put in there and update, but I wondered, are those survival foods that are in the play and that get so many laughs when they have the ice cream sticks that last for hundreds of years? Yes, they're still for sale. There are even more of them. and they are selling survival food kits. They're quite costly. The one I'm looking at costs $434 for a 30-day supply, but they have a shelf life of 20 to 30 years.
Oh, boy.
The business is bigger than ever, and the luxury condominium is absolutely based on reality. There is an actual luxury condominium with, you know, multi-hundreds of thousands or million-dollar apartments, and there's no nuclear war. All they need is each other. It's two married couples that literally go at it. I think it's a funny no exit for our time, but this is bigger than ever because of the state of the world and the, you know, all the new problems that have been exacerbated very recently, getting worse and worse. So more and more people think they can do a hands-on survival. I doubt that any of this would work. In fact, some of the people, I checked on them, and they invested heavily in the, you know, these underground homes, and one of them bought property on Three Mile Island. It's always ironic when you set out to do something that will guarantee your survival no matter what happens. And the character in the play calls it the mega mess, but I don't know if I can say the word on radio, but he always, the shit storm is coming. And it's here for sure. I mean, everyone knows it's here. So the time is actually now. I mean, I remember when the play was first on, that people said, oh, you know, this is very funny, you know, but now I'll see if it's funny because it's now far more true. And that's going to be very curious to see if this survivalist character is as hilarious and ludicrous as he was when I first thought of him. But I think these people are operating under a big delusion, and the comedy exposes that, because would they really be happy, these big outdoorsy guys in even a luxury Mondo condo is a small space that he can't get out of for a long period of time. So I took that as the premise as to what would happen if you had two married couples in this really sort of terrible chamber that they can't get out, even though it's very attractive. The set is supposed to look beautiful. It's been done, you know, several times, and in Chicago it was done, but they never did the romance of the underground. I was very disappointed, to be honest, but I love Steppenwolf, and they were a wonderful group of actors. But I have wonderful actors here, and I'm really looking forward to seeing the play again. And everyone is wanting to see it because it just seems to be of this time. And I remember my editor at The New Yorker, you know, I published two memoirs with The New Yorker. He said, when he read the play, he said, well, this is the most prophetic play of our time. And I hope people enjoy it. And great fun to write it.
It takes place in a cave home built to withstand wars and pandemics, economic collapse, you name it. But yes. The surprise is there's a visit from some friends from New York.
That's right. It's built to withstand any kind of war, economic collapse, pandemic, but it can't withstand a visit from his wife's friend from New York.
It all goes a little haywire.
Yes. Well, it's a play also about marriages. We have two marriages that implode underground, and one is a long-running marriage, a couple from New York. They've had 27 marital separations, but they can't quite go through it, and they're very incompatible, and the wife has actually kind of lied about the purpose of this trip, and the husband is being dragged along. He said it's always wrong to leave the apartment. He's just the essence of a New Yorker, and he's trying to finish his thesis, and he doesn't want to be disturbed. And he has a refrain in the play, just leave me alone in peace and quiet. The other couple are newlyweds, which is, you know, the catch, because this is the woman from New York, Sheila. It's her best friend, Bev, long-term best girlfriend, and she's suddenly up and married. We sense for the third or fourth time the man of her dreams, who she met when she went on an outward bound vacation in Death Valley, and he was the leader of the expedition, and he's wildly attractive. I have to say, his attractiveness owes something to the fact that I was also at the same time profiling some very attractive male movie stars, and their charisma sort of sank into this play as well. She actually goes into a kind of sexual trance, and they don't know that her husband is into this underground life and is a diehard survivalist until they're there. And of course, once they're in it, they're stuck with each other. And as the character says, the problem is always deep. And Underground does suit this play. It's kind of a subversive work, but it also takes place in a subterranean apartment.
Now, that was performed also at Widow Jane Mine. I've never been there, but I've come to understand that's underground, right?
It is. Well, I couldn't resist. And actually, the people that were organizing, they do wonderful theatrical and musical events in there. The cave is enormous. It's a fantastic cavern that was man-made. It was made to excavate what became the cement used in the Brooklyn Bridge. But it's a very romantic, mysterious, huge cavern with an underground river. And there haven't been too many recent theatricals at the time we did Bang, but I had seen one and I was entranced with the idea of doing my underground play actually underground. And it worked beautifully there. They had a lighting company light the stone walls and the underground river, and built kind of a cute little set.
Oh, what fun!
Yeah, it was great fun. And we also had wonderful actors for that. We had local actors from our company, actors and writers. It was just great fun. It was scary doing it in the cave because you can't really secure it safely. And we had one night with thunder and lightning, and I was terrified that the play would be fatal. It's also, I have to say, I would give it at least an R to X rating. And we put out a warning to, you know, people that might be offended that they would not want to come. And they came.
And they came.
We were all in the front row. But they didn't complain. They seemed to actually have some sort of interest. We could have run forever, but we decided after the thunder and lightning storm that we should get out of the cave.
A smart move. Before we conclude, tell us a little bit about the actors. They all have some.
Yes. Well, the survivalist is being played by a fantastic actor, Michael O'Keefe, who had been Oscar nominated for a role in The Great Santini, in which he played the son of another actor that I know, Robert Duvall. And he then went on and was very well known for Caddyshack. You know, all the actors in the New York radius get called in to be cast for a Law and Order, usually Special Victims Unit, SVU. And I saw Michael the other night as the corrupt priest, Father Eugene, and he's so good in that. I had the idea that it would be fun to have a husband and wife. And Michael O'Keefe is married to a terrific actor. Emily Donahoe is going to be playing his bride in this. So, and then there's a fantastic actress right locally in our area, but has also been on Broadway many times and was just seen recently in the TV series Succession, Lori Wilner. And I just worked with her at Maverick Concerts. She's multi-talented. She's a terrific actress and a singer and a musician. She's really wonderful. She composes. She also writes. So she is going to be playing what we call the wife from New York, who causes all the problems, really, much worse than the survivalist. And she is married to the character Len, who is the intellectual who didn't want to leave his apartment. And he's being played by a very fantastic guy, John Pielmeyer, who's famous in many ways, but probably most known as a playwright for the very terrific play Agnes of God. And he's also done the theatrical version of The Exorcist, which was a big hit on the West End in London and is to come to New York on Broadway. But he has acted for many, many years in New York and the Actors Theater of Louisville and in film and series. And he's also a novelist. He wrote a terrific book that was published called Hook's Tale. Lots of talent there on the stage. So I'm really looking forward to seeing them as an ensemble.
Well, it's going to be a very special show, and it's on for one day, one show only, so you got to get there.
Reservations are piling on.
That's Sunday, November 16th at 2 p.m. at the Rosendale Theater in Rosendale, New York. And more information at rosendaletheater.org. And that is theater with an R-E.
I'll be there.
Well, enjoy.
I will. And thank you so much, Valerie.
You are welcome.
Thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi for that. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Today's weather, breezy with a snow shower possible, high 44. Tonight's low 25 with some flurries in the forecast. Tomorrow's high only 32 with a couple of morning flurries. This is WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.